This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's our weekly review of news affecting the tri-state area. Joining me this afternoon, Cincinnati Inquirer government reporter Jesse Balmert, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can be part of the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jesse, Andy, and Howard, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start by talking about what's going on with Ohio's governor's race. How crowded is this becoming, Jesse?
It's becoming quite crowded. We actually added two people, both originally from the Dayton area, last week. Ohio Secretary of State John Husted on the Republican side, and then Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley on the Dem side. So we have four people expected to run on the GOP side, and at least four people expected to run on the Democrat side, which is quite a few.
And that's just so far, right?
Yes.
That's so far.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, we're one short away from a baseball team right now. Right. We put them all together.
Yeah, we just need a pitcher.
Yeah, would they be the Reds or the Indians? That's the question. But we can have an argument about that for a long time.
You would
time.
Think that we would have learned from large primaries in, say, the most recent cycle, but...
Well, yeah, I think that's right. I think they'd much rather avoid this, kind of battle. And it is going to be a battle, believe me. And the parties, would just as soon not have it, spending a whole lot of money and creating a whole lot of division within the party. I can see that happening easily on both sides, really.
I think we're just right now we're in such a state of fluidity with politics in Ohio that nobody really knows what people are going to grab onto. What kind of politician are they going to grab onto? Yeah. Are they going to be a Trump voter? Are they going to be a Kasich Republican? What kind of Democrats are out there? And so I think everybody wants to kind of test the waters to see which brand of politics are people going to connect with. So that's why it's such an open field right now.
Yeah. I mean, there's one. Oh, go ahead. Good.
And the sides are crowded for different reasons. On the Republican side, it's because all but one statewide office holder is a Republican, and on the Democrat side, it's because all but one statewide office holder is a Republican. So
they're all term limited out and running for other offices. Yeah,
exactly. And perhaps people, if there were more Democrats in statewide offices, there would be a more obvious choice on the Democrat side. But right now, it's just, well, that person looks good. That person has some good credentials. Do they have the fundraising chops to do a statewide race? Nobody really knows.
So far, John Husted is in on the Republican side. Nan Whaley is in on the Democratic side. Now, who else is in for the Republicans at this point?
You've got Jim Renacci, who's a congressperson up in the Cleveland area, and then you have talks of Mary Taylor, who's already filed her official paperwork to run for governor, and then Attorney General Mike DeWine, who has not officially announced, but when asked, he basically gives a wink and a nod to, he's going to be entering this race. And the big thing there, when you look at the polls and you look at the studies, it looks like DeWine will definitely have the biggest edge with the most name recognition and the most popularity among any of the candidates from either party.
Yeah, he's going to be a force to be reckoned with. I mean, he's been in public office for well over 30 years, and he's a familiar name. Now, the one that's interesting to me, and you talk about this a little bit, about, the appeal to Trump voters in Ohio, who are a considerable force apparently now, is Jim Renacci. And I think he's targeting that group. And looking at the other three and saying, these are establishment type candidates. I'm the guy who is different. I'm the guy who is, more of a populist Trump type candidate. And he's going to try to appeal to those voters. And in a four-way primary, that could work.
Yeah. Well, and on the Democratic side, we mentioned Nan Whaley. Now, Howard, who are the other Democrats?
Well, you've got Betty Sutton, former member of Congress, and Joe Schiavone, who's a state senator. He was the minority leader of the state Senate. Connie Pillage from Cincinnati, who was a former state representative, and she ran for treasurer in a very bad year for Democrats and got beat by Josh Mandel. She's announced and is running for governor. So that's what you've got at this point. Now, everybody's sitting around waiting to see whether or not Rich Cordray, the former attorney general, who is now part of the who now heads the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in Washington, is going to be able to return to Ohio and jump into this race. If he did, he might become automatic front runner because he's well known. He's been on the ballot before. He can raise a lot of money. But I think if you look at this field on the Democratic side right now, Nan Whaley, I think, is going to be a formidable candidate because she's, number one, she's running for re-election this year as mayor of Dayton without opposition. And she's been a formidable fundraiser, and she's going to be able to, you know, basically do this full time, go around the state and run for governor.
Jesse, what are your thoughts on Nan Whaley running in this?
Well, I mean, I think she, like Howard was saying, she has a lot of experience in Dayton. She doesn't have a lot of experience raising money statewide. So, but neither does really anybody on this Democratic slate. So I think that's really what the Democrats are going to be looking for is who can raise the money to challenge somebody like Mike DeWine or challenge somebody like really anybody on the GOP side. And there's just not a lot of evidence that they've done that previously.
But there is a kind
doesn't
of
mean
a
they can't.
Yeah.
Oh, doesn't mean they can't, just means they haven't.
But Nan Whaley is part of this kind of a network of up-and-coming young Democratic political types who do know how to raise money, and they can raise money in all parts of the state. John Cranley, the mayor of Cincinnati, is supporting her, number one, and he's certainly a prodigious fundraiser. You know, he helped the Hillary Clinton campaign to a great extent in this town. So,
and you mentioned that 2014 was a bad year for Democrats. I think ever since then, since David Pepper took over the Ohio Democratic Party, they've really been focusing on building up these kind of city and county officials to be able to run statewide. And so this is a bit of a test of that program.
That's right. It's the bench. You know, it's time to put the bench out there.
So Nan Whaley is running completely unopposed, Howard, for Dayton mayor.
Right.
Is there any possibility somebody might jump into the race and say, wait a minute, you can't do both things?
It's done. It's over.
It's done.
She's
not going to have any opposition.
No. There was a guy who tried to file and failed, you know, to come up with the necessary signatures. This is it. I mean, she's going to be she's going to be reelected mayor of Dayton, Ohio, my hometown, in the fall. And at the same time, she will be very, very active in running around the state and getting herself better known in the other media markets around Ohio, which, of course, you have to do.
And now, so what you have here is you do have Nan Whaley, who's Dayton mayor, and so now she has time to go around statewide. Like you mentioned earlier, Connie Pillage, who ran for treasurer, she's already run a statewide campaign, so she has that experience going for her.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that was a bad year for all Democrats. Well, she put up the biggest fight among all the other people in the field when at the top of the ticket was Ed Fitzgerald.
Yeah, she did the best of that Democratic field that year.
And I think so. Again, it's all sort of a toss up right now. But I think the thing that Connie Pillage has going for her is that she is a veteran. She's run statewide before. She's known for being very energetic. She knows how to knock on people's doors to talk to people one on one and really relate to people. And then you have Joe Schiavone, who is a state senator. And again, when we mention these names, they're very familiar to us. We cover these people on a daily basis, but none of these people have good name recognition statewide. And so it is going to be a battle to see who can get the Democratic primary or to get the Democratic nomination. But then whoever comes out of the Republican field, presumably if we would just to think it were to be DeWine, then they would have a huge uphill climb after that.
the Democratic field is really interesting because you've got some battlers here. I mean, some people really know how to get into a political scrap. I mean, with Connie Pillage, after the last census, when she was in the Ohio House, they redrew her district. And they basically turned it into a Republican district and said, mm-hmm. okay, you go run and good luck to you. And she ran in this fairly Republican district and won. And she did it with shoe leather and knocking on doors and making phone calls and doing all the grassroots stuff that you have to do in an Ohio House race. I mean, she is a tireless campaigner. Whaley's the same way. Betty Sutton's been there and done that.
And I think Nan Whaley can make the argument, too, at least in the primary level, that she's the only one with executive experience.
Well, she is, yeah. I mean, as far as, running a city government.
513-419-7100, if you would like to join us in our conversation. Any other names? Rich, we mentioned Rich Cordray. His name's been floating around as somebody else who might get into the governor's race. Is there anybody else at this point who's out there? Could this field get even bigger than it is?
I mean, if you want to get into the coulda, woulda, shouldas, I mean, I think Nina Turner is a person that the progressives like to toss around. She was a former state senator, and she kind of won against the Ohio Democratic Party's general fold to support Bernie Sanders in the primary, in the Democratic presidential primary. She became a huge advocate for him and really a person who was out there talking him up, and then she was even a possibility for vice president on the Green Party ticket, which was interesting. So I think every once in a while I get these, Facebook alerts like, run, Nina, run, which mm-hmm. was her.
Yeah, from the progressive groups that I've really been trying to draft her. And Turner's from the Cleveland area, so she would have a lot of support from Cuyahoga County and Northeast Ohio. And she would really be able to tap into that progressive wave, the Bernie supporters who are out there. And I really do think that if she were to jump into the race, which I haven't heard any hints of, I really do think that she would bring a little more clout to the race. I think that she might be actually like a standout in the race if she were to jump in.
Yeah, she could be formidable while she is, or if she did do that. I'm not sure that this field is going to grow that much more. I think the growth area is down ticket in some of the other statewide constitutional offices, because now you're starting to see people come out and announce for, Secretary of State and State Auditor and some of the other offices, all of which are open this year because of the term limits.
The others are term limited, right? The people in the office right now.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the Republicans who are running for governor. I mean, Mike DeWine, the Attorney General, John Husted, the Secretary of State. Well, they're term limited out of their present jobs, and of course, now they're running for governor.
We will continue our review of the news, and you can join us, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and it's our weekly review of news affecting the tri-state area. And joining me this afternoon, Cincinnati Inquirer government reporter Jesse Baumert, Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Kevin in Dayton joins us now, so let's take Kevin's question. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. I had just a quick kind of general question, and that was everything that happened in 2016 with cyber hacking that is still in the news today. Just curious how much you have seen or what you think the current candidates that you've been talking about are preparing to defend themselves against that.
Think that extends into the Ohio governor's race, Howard, or any of the statewide constitutional races?
I don't know. I mean, number one, in terms of the voting systems themselves, none of the votes are online, so you can't hack into that. You can hack into voter registration roles somehow, you know, if you had the ability. And I suppose that, you know, some sophisticated hackers could hack into particular candidates' databases. But, I mean, I just don't see it as a major problem at the state level.
As an issue in a statewide race, yeah.
Because the votes themselves are not online in Ohio.
And he might be talking about what we saw last year with the DNC staff email hacks.
Right.
I think that everybody is more alert to these types of things. I mean, if you talk to major universities and research groups, these are things that they've been putting up walls and guards on for years now. And I think maybe now that it's been apparent that politics can be hacked as well, that politics can become a target. I haven't talked to either the Ohio Democratic Party or Ohio Republican Party about this, but I'm sure that they're making sure that they have up to date, you know, protection against that kind of thing. And if you talk to just state government workers, there's more cybersecurity when it comes to protecting data and information among the departments, where they have to have stronger passwords, where they have to have more clearance for things. So it's definitely, because of what happened last year, has definitely raised awareness and heightened responsibility for a lot of people.
So Howard, what do you think the key issues are going to be in the governor's race?
Well, the key issues in governor's race, I think, are going to be the economy. What is the state of the economy going to be a year from now in Ohio? You know, the governor has declared that we're, you know, on the verge of recession in Ohio. And I think really one of the big issues that's going to come up is kind of an old issue that Kasich, you know, early in his administration with the Ohio General Assembly, the Republicans, took away local government fund and the estate tax, and it crippled many, many local governments, particularly township governments, all over the state of Ohio. And those people are crying to out to the gubernatorial candidates, are you going to restore this money? We're sitting on a $2 billion rainy day fund. Can we have some of that money back? And I think that the gubernatorial candidates are going to be forced to address that issue in one way or the other.
And you know what? I moderated a forum with Ohio Democratic Party Chair David Pepper and Franklin County Republican Chair Brad Sennett, and things were pretty nice, and everybody was pretty civil until it came to the opioid epidemic, and that's when things really got fiery, and local government fund got involved there, because David Pepper with the Democrats would say, you know, he didn't want to point to that as the direct cause, but he said because local governments don't even have enough funding, they can't tackle this issue head on. So I think if we're going to hear about local government funding, I think that's the arena we're going to hear it in, is this opioid crisis. And I think that among Republicans and Democrats, they're really going to have to explain, what are they going to do to take on this epidemic head on, because it's just glaring us in the face. We're the worst in the country when it comes to opioid overdose deaths.
And Schiavone suggested that the money from the rainy day fund be used for that purpose?
Yeah, I think all of the candidates are really honing in on this issue. So I agree that I think that the drug epidemic is going to be huge in the 2018 gubernatorial race.
Yeah.
This week, Joe Schiavone and Kenny Yuko, who's the new Senate minority leader, they had a press conference saying they want to put $200 million of the rainy day fund into some treatments, some data analysis of, you know, what's covered and what's not covered. And some of that would flow through the local government fund, actually.
It would go to the local government fund, but it would be for specific things. So it wouldn't just be here's more money in the local government fund. But yeah, and they're kind of, so I mean, because when you hear LGF or the local government fund, that's kind of a buzzword for a lot of people who are sensitive to the fact that their local government funds were cut years ago.
And like Mike DeWine this week, I think, was talking to students about the drug issue. So it's certainly something the candidates are making their voices heard on.
Jesse's, and another thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've got one of the worst problems of any state in the nation. I mean, it's got to be an issue.
Andy, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that this is an issue that, going back to David Pepper, who's the Democratic Party chair, he ran against Attorney General Mike DeWine for Attorney General in 2014, and the opioid epidemic was the biggest issue. He made it about that the entire time, and I just expect the Democrats to constantly be pushing the fact that this has happened under Republican control.
And they're talking
whether
about
that's fair or not.
They're talking, Jesse, about tapping $200 million in the rainy day fund. How much of the rainy day fund does that represent?
I think it's about 10%.
Okay.
Yeah, it's $2 billion. And for the record, Democrats are in the minority here in the Ohio General Assembly. Mm-hmm. And so the odds of that happening are probably pretty slim. Both the governor and the leaders of the GOP caucuses have said, we're not going to touch the rainy day fund. So
they are pretty.
This is a policy discussion and also a gubernatorial bid discussion as much as anything else.
The odds are very slim that the legislature would do this. There's no question about that. But it does make a heck of a good campaign issue for Democrats running for governor.
Jesse, the economy more than likely is going to be an issue, Ohio's economy. And you and Chrissy Thompson did a story where you asked the question, what's wrong with Ohio's economy? And I'm wondering if you can tell us what is wrong. Did you find anything in looking at this? Is Governor Kasich right? Are we on the verge of a recession?
So we found some old problems and a few new problems. But we did this story in part because I actually hate economy stories, because the governor likes to say they're like prognosticators or what have you. Obviously, economists, you know a lot about what directions we could possibly be going in, but it always seems like there's 50 different explanations for why we are where we are. But by strict definition, we are not in a recession, because a recession is when output is going down, when our gross domestic product is going down, and it is not in Ohio. It is not, you know, super boisterous right now, but it's not declining. So strictly speaking, we're not in a recession, like the governor says. But there are reasons why he said that. Our revenues, the money that we're bringing in from taxes, especially from income taxes, have not been hitting the mark. And so that's one thing that is a little concerning. But a lot of the problems with Ohio's economy are problems that we've had for a while. Our population is declining a little, or it's not growing as fast as the nation's. We're a little bit older than the nation. We're a little bit more reliant on manufacturing than the nation is. And so all of these factors just make Ohio's economy a little bit more slow growing than the nation's, which has been slow growing generally.
Now, what's going on in the statewide races? Who have we got running so far for Attorney General Howard? How's that shaping up?
Well, Attorney General David Yost, who's now the state auditor, Republican state auditor, is running. Steve Dettelbach on the Democratic side, who's a former U.S. attorney from Northern District of Ohio, he seems to be committed to this thing on the Democratic side. Yost is actively running for Attorney General right now.
Okay, Secretary of State.
Well, Secretary of State, we just had Kathleen Clyde, state representative, who is kind of specialized in these voters' rights issues. She is running for sure, and there's two on the Republican side, State Senator
Frank LaRose. And Dorothy Palanda.
They're both interesting candidates, and, if you look at LaRose's website, I mean, it's great, but, and he talks, there's a video where he talks about Ohio and talks about all the issues, and talks about just about everything except voting. So,
the primary job of the Secretary of State, okay.
Yeah. Well, but, I mean, the Secretary of State also is responsible for business filings and that sort of thing, but, it's one of those races where, Kathleen Clyde, on the other hand, is pretty much laser focused on voter rights issues and makes the argument that, over the last 4 to 8 years, that Republicans in the legislature and John Houston, the Republican incumbent, have done everything they possibly can to try to limit people's access to the polls. particularly Democrats and African Americans.
And I would say that Frank LaRose, who's a state senator here from the Akron area, he also has been laser focused on elections issues, but coming from a different angle. So so what he's done, for example, has gotten rid of Golden Week, where you can vote and register at the same time. But he was also a big voice in pushing for online voter registration, which is what something we now have in Ohio. And so he's been very much elections issues has been his legislative priority as well, but not as far as trying to open up as much as Kathleen Clyde has talked about. And so I think the thing that would be interesting, if these are the two that end up facing each other in a general election, if Frank LaRose and Kathleen Clyde face each other, I think it'll be really interesting and I think really fun to watch, because these are two who have kind of battled back and forth inside the state house, two people who have been focusing on elections issues with very different mindsets about how they should go about it.
Yeah, and perhaps will tell us a lot about how Ohio wants this to go.
Yeah.
Who's in the auditor's race, Howard?
Right now, Keith Faber, who's the former Ohio Senate president on the Republican side, he seems to be committed to the thing. The Democrats, it's kind of sketchy at this point. David Leland, the former state party chair and now state representative, seems to be interested in, I know he's interested in running for statewide office, auditor, or possibly treasurer, but you know, he hasn't formally jumped into the thing yet.
And treasurer's race?
Well, treasurer's race, you've got Clarence Mingo, the Franklin County auditor, has jumped into this thing really early. And Robert Sprague, who's a state representative from Findlay, is getting into the thing. Democratic side seems to be a little unclear at this point.
So I wanted to ask Jesse and Andy, have you been keeping track of Governor Kasich?
Yeah, he's been making the rounds lately, hasn't he?
Yeah,
it hasn't been too hard to keep track of him, right?
Right. Yeah, he was actually in Columbus a couple of times this week.
Right.
He spoke to the Columbus Metropolitan Club, more of talking. I would say promoting his book that has come out, and then he also spoke at the Holocaust Memorial commemoration. Earlier this week as well. So yeah, he's been making the rounds, but still kind of sticking to the point of the themes that are in his book, which is just trying to bring the country back together. This two paths idea, where people are so laser focused on their own politics that they can't reach out and identify with other people's ideas. This is the thing that he's still out there promoting.
Yeah, he talks about.
He has a lot of advice for his former GOP presidential contender, Donald Trump. So,
yeah,
such as,
he should have people in his life to explain to him national policies, like, you know, when to share important information and when not to share important information, and that if those people aren't willing to stand up to Trump, that they should be willing to resign.
It also seems like one of the more interesting roles that the governor's been taking is whenever there's the newest scandal coming out of the White House, the governor's one of the first people to send out a tweet with a statement responding to it. And that's, I feel like what's happening now is he's establishing this kind of role as the counter argument for Republicans.
Is he saying, I told you so? Is that what he's doing?
I mean, he wants to be the conscience of the party. He wants to be the conscience of the Republican Party. And he wants to be the person who answers the Trump people when the people in Congress, you know, sit down and shut up and let this stuff go on.
But he still hasn't said, I'm running.
No.
He still says,
he's not going to say that. No. He's not going to say that by any means. And, you know, he's going to let this thing play out and see where it goes. And then at some point he'll make a decision. Right now his top priority, I think, is selling books.
You know what he's doing right now is exactly what he was doing for an entire year before he announced he was running for president.
True.
Which is saying, I'm just focusing on this right now. At the time before he ran for president, he said, I'm just focusing on being governor. I'm just focusing on this. I'm thinking about it, but that's not my main priority. I'm thinking about this. And that's kind of what he's doing right now. I'm just here to talk about this. I'm just here to talk about that. Right. I might run, maybe not. But I mean, he's good at giving a non-answer answer when it comes to these types of questions.
Yeah. Jesse and Andy, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Cincinnati Inquirer government reporter Jesse Ballmert and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter and producer Andy Chow. And Howard Wilkinson will be back for the next segment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. It's our weekly review of local news. I'm Mark Haney, along with WCPO.com politics and government reporters Paula Christian and Amanda Seitz, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Howard Wilkinson's also back with us, our politics reporter here. Thank you, Howard. And thank you, Amanda and Paula, for being here.
Thanks for having us.
You've been doing some reporting on the banks. What's the latest here? What are you looking at?
For a year now, we've really been trying to track down information about what was going on. We had a concert venue proposal that came up about a year and a half ago, and we couldn't get much in the way of answers as to where that concert proposal stood. So we started asking, hey, when is this bank's steering committee that oversees all of the development on the banks, really? When are they meeting? We were told that they weren't meeting. So the latest is that they still haven't met 2 years after their last meeting.
They haven't met 2 years after their... Okay, so I'm confused. Have they or have they not met? Do we really know?
Well, they told us that there had been no public meetings since May of 2015. So we put in public records request to the city and the county asking for information about the banks. And it revealed several emails and documents that showed there have been meetings going on regarding the banks. And it is unclear if it is the steering committee, if it's parts of the steering committee, if it's certain just little groups within the committee. But during this time, the UC Law School was proposed to relocate at the banks and ultimately did not. But during this whole discussion period, not a single public meeting.
So the point of this is there's been a lot of taxpayer money going into the banks, but not much taxpayer input. Am I getting that right, Amanda?
Well, certainly taxpayers haven't had really a chance to provide input any time within the last 2 years. Even the county commission has not received an update on where the bank stands since December of 2015. So, you know,
As we asked around to leaders, nobody had any idea, like, oh, well, we haven't heard anything on the banks in a while. What have you heard? And it has been so difficult to find information on this one topic. It's I describe it as a black hole of information.
How's it compared to other local developments?
That's what, I mean, struck us as odd, too, is here you have a land that is owned by the taxpayers as well. The banks is the land is. And other neighborhoods, when developers try to come into like Over the Rhine, for example, or even Oakley, they face a lot of scrutiny with, especially if they are getting tax abatements, with what they're planning to put in there. Does it fit with the feel of the neighborhood? Does it offer affordable housing? Does it keep a walkable neighborhood if this development goes in? But you don't hear those questions. In fact, we had one member of the Urban Design Review Committee that said that they're usually one of the last people to find out about the deals at the banks. They're not able to offer input on what these buildings look like. And that's contributed to what a lot of architectural critics say is a kind of suburban feel at the banks. It doesn't look like a part of a city, really.
And the other part to this whole story is Promo West, the concert promoter, they have been trying to build a venue in Cincinnati for 3 years. They have spent $100,000 coming up with plans trying to get an indoor-outdoor concert arena built here. All of this started when we tried to find out, would they be approved? Would they not be approved? nobody could answer any of our questions. And so 3 years to, I mean, now he's still waiting. He heard first that he was turned down at the banks. Then he heard, no, he hasn't been turned down. And he can't even get an answer as to, do they like my proposal? Do they not? Should I look somewhere else? It's really confusing for everybody.
Has anybody ever put together statistics that look at the number of people who visit the banks on weekdays, weekends? Has anybody ever looked at the actual numbers of people that it's drawing?
No, but we've certainly heard concern from public officials about just the viability of restaurants there, new businesses that come in, because you do only have the Reds and the Bengals. You have Smale Riverfront Park. You have the National Underground Freedom Center, too, is kind of destinations that people would want to go to. But is that sustainable for the bank's viability?
And let's not forget that we've had 6 restaurants that have closed in the last 2 years.
They open, they fail, and then somebody else comes in, and then they fail.
And the common theme is there's not enough people to support it. I leaders are concerned. I mean, I know we've spoken to Yvette Simpson, the mayoral candidate, city councilwoman, who would like to see more office jobs down there. So it would be helpful for us, and I think for everybody, to just sort of understand where things stand. Phase 3, where does that stand? What's next for the banks?
Is the bank steering committee, have you determined if it is a public body that needs to have open meetings?
Oh, that's the question right there.
It has been in past years. They've noticed their meetings. They did have an issue with a Cincinnati Inquirer reporter 2 years ago when they last met, or around the time that they last met, where they booted that reporter from the meeting. So it's kind of always been a little bit of a sticky situation.
The media attorney we spoke to said, absolutely, these are public meetings.
They're appointed. The people that run this committee are appointed by the county and the city. Typically makes them.
They should be, yeah. They should be open meetings. Yeah.
But I guess if they had been publicly meeting, we could be allowed to go, but they say there have been no meetings, but the emails and the documents that we have show otherwise.
Where does the story go next?
Well, we have heard from some, we've talked to some of the members on the board. So you can look for, shameless plug here, you can look for that follow-up on Monday at WCPO.com.
Okay. Now, also we had a development in the Center for Closing the Health Gap, which the two of you have also been extensively reporting on. What's the latest here? The audit just came out? The audit results just were released?
Yeah, it really confirmed a lot of what we had found in our reporting. There were many instances where the Center for Closing the Health Gap had billed the city for some questionable invoices. So some of those included instances where they billed for work done on a political group, a local political group called the Black Agenda. Some of the work they billed for lacked really adequate descriptions of the work that was done, or in some cases was billed in advance of the work that was done. And then on the other side, the city really took a lot of the blame here in that audit. They admitted that they do not have people, they did not adequately train people essentially to review these invoices and approve them as well.
They all but admitted that nobody was looking at the invoices that were submitted. They just paid them. So that apparently will change, but it certainly begs the question of, if this agency is audited, what about the other ones that just get blanket checks from the city to do work? What are they doing with that money? What are they billing the city for? When I spoke to the mayor very early on about this story, I said, we decided to look at one nonprofit. What if we looked at all of them? I mean, what would that show? What is the city paying? Without even knowing what they're paying for.
Well, and the money that was being looked into was what, $2.75 million, I think, was what the audit was looking at.
And the city expects to recoup between $15,000 and $20,000 from Center for Closing the Health Gap for expenses the city should not have paid for.
So where does this go? I mean, I guess they're going to be under more scrutiny then in terms of their spending.
They're going to be under more scrutiny, but I mean, you're exactly right, Amanda. This was, to me, when I read it, it was more about the city's responsibility. in monitoring these things and keeping track of this money. And they're going to have to do a whole lot of work. And Harry Black said in the report, in the audit, that that's what we're going to do. We're going to set up the training and the structure to be able to do this. But it was more the city's fault than the center's fault.
And certainly, too, the other issue that was raised in the audit was that the contract itself, there were several points where they said it was really too vague to even enforce some of the contract terms.
It's the problem when you allow essentially outside agencies that get city funding to write their own contract. This wouldn't happen if the city had a contract in place and before they gave them money. But because you're putting the cart before the horse, they get the money from city council, then they go write their own contract and they tell the city, here's what we can do. And it's so vague that it's unenforceable.
Harry Black said that the health gap was compliant during this audit. However, there was a note in the audit that really stuck out to me, because if you read audits, they're usually pretty dry. But there was a point in the audit where, because the health gap wrote their own contract, there was performance measures, too, that they wrote. They decided their own performance measures to get this money. And when the auditors tried to get information to confirm that the health gap had met performance measures, the health gap refused to turn over some of that information. And so the auditors were like, why would you make this a performance measure?
Have we gotten any kind of a reaction from the center itself?
We asked for comment yesterday and did not hear back.
I think it's also important to note, while the audit raises all of these discrepancies, puts the blame on the city, but Harry Black also did put some of the blame on the health gap for not – you have a responsibility to do the work you say you're going to do. He also still recommended them to be fully funded at their $750,000 ask of the city this fiscal year. Well, when the city is facing an extremely tight budget, he still recommends them fully funded.
Any more audits that might come in this?
Yeah, so Keep Cincinnati Beautiful is also facing an audit as well, as a result of some concerns over how their director, I believe, handled some funds. Brad Lindner had notified the city of this in advance, that they had found some discrepancies. So I believe that is also facing.
Yeah, he referenced this, we have another audit now. And he said that these are pretty common issues that he didn't. Whatever they looked at the health gap, now they'll be looking at at Keep Cincinnati Beautiful. But now Harry Black will have Center for Closing the Health Gap if they do get funding from the city next year. Their contract is directly in his office. So if there are any more discrepancies, his office will take the blame.
Right.
Howard, the city mistakenly honored the killer of Cincinnati police officer Sonny Kim by issuing a proclamation that June 1st of this year would be Trey Day, and Trey being Trey Pierre Hummins, who shot Kim, then killed himself June 19th of 2015. Now, the proclamation's been retracted. The mayor has apologized profusely for this happening.
How does something like extraordinary way? Yes.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate timing too, because this comes during Police Memorial Week.
Right.
But how does something like this happen?
Well, that's a real good question. How does it happen? I mean, that mayor's offices and other, governor's offices, legislatures, they get these requests for proclamations, by the dozens. And generally speaking, there is somebody in the office who is there for the purpose of vetting these things, looking at them and saying, okay, is this just, for somebody's grandmother's 100th birthday and, a harmless proclamation? Or is there a red flag that comes up and, it's too controversial or just plain wrong, and then they say no. Well, that didn't happen in this case. It was just the rubber stamp. John Cranley never even saw this thing. It was staff people who did this. And I think, and it was pretty clear from what the mayor's communications director was saying last night at the FOP hall, that she really wasn't aware of who this was that they were honoring, or that what this was exactly about. And so it was just basically stamped with his signature.
So I take it they're going to be much more cautious in the future?
They'd better be. I mean, you can't do this. I mean, this was extraordinary. What an extraordinary scene this was last night.
It really was.
At the FOP hall, where the mayor of the city of Cincinnati comes. He has already apologized to Sonny Kim's widow and to the FOP president and others, but he stands up in public and he breaks down in tears and he can't even speak. He can't speak because of how emotionally affected he was by this. And I think that was genuine. It was absolutely genuine. You can't fake that. So, no, yeah, he's going to put some safeguards in place, but we'll see what the effect of this is going to be.
Paula, Amanda, and Howard, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
WCPO.com politics and government reporters Paula Christian and Amanda Seitz, and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson.